Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Pete St. Pandemonium, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com, where we take you down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be, with conversations from those who paved the way. And now the GWH Radio Network presents Pete St. Pandemonium.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium. This is Mike Morris, and as always, I am joined by my co-hosts, Gary Oates and Bobby Simmons. I know how I'm feeling tonight, guys. I hope you guys are doing much better. What's going on in your neck of the woods?
Well, I hope you get the feeling better, Mike. That's for sure.
Yeah, I hope. He was up here over the weekend. I really hate he's sick, but I'm glad he's there.
Put that in his bag on the way out the door or what?
Oh, geez. How cold is it supposed to get in Savannah tonight, Jerry?
It's going to start dropping, Bobby. How cold, I don't know yet. I know it's supposed to get down there.
Yeah, they're saying 28 here in Atlanta tonight.
Well, I mean, look at the weather here, which I haven't done much of anything since Monday. Take medicine and cough. But I did see on Facebook my cousin who lives in Nashville. His wife posted on there that it was already sleeting in Nashville.
Lord.
I guess. Oh, man. Atlanta, though, the whole time I lived there, I always said that it almost always rang true. If it's going to snow in Atlanta, it's going to snow in December or February. Even though I remember one year it snowed in March. March or April.
I was on the way to the ballpark. I was supposed to umpire a tournament that March when it snowed. I was on the way to the ballpark. It started snowing. And I can remember hanging a U-turn and going right back to the house.
Where was it you and Charlie got snowed in, Bobby?
That was Thomaston, Georgia. Or Charlie got home. I got snowed in.
When was that, Bobby? 72,
73? 73.
Yeah, I got caught too. I got caught coming from Savannah. When I got to Macon, I couldn't believe it.
Oh yeah,
it come right across the state.
Yes, sir. I went to the promoter. There was a Judy, and I can't remember her last name. She was the promoter in Griffin, and she came over and picked me up the next day, and took me to Griffin, and it hadn't even rained in Griffin. They thought we were lying when we were talking about we snowed in.
I remember that well.
Well, hopefully it won't snow down here because that's all I need.
Yeah, I don't.
You're not supposed to get snow, are you, Bobby?
No, just supposed to be cold. They said we may get some flurries, but just nothing major.
It's going to be 37 here tonight.
Well, we're supposed to be here.
Well, we hadn't had a winter here, I know that.
I don't know, it's got cold up here a little bit. One of the times I was up there, it was a little nippy. Nothing like it normally is, but, of course, the summer was so hot. There's no telling what it's going to do.
Yeah, it was hot. It was a hot summer.
I'm not supposed to have this year anyway, right?
Do what?
I said, according to the Mayans, it's all supposed to have this year anyway.
Yeah, what difference does it make, right?
Yeah. Well, I don't care how cold it gets. I mean, I don't care anything about the snow and ice, but the cold don't bother me.
No, you put on enough stuff to keep warm.
Yes, sir.
And put a log on the fireplace.
That's exactly.
So what... Do the when it gets cold down there on Tybee Island, do the animals go crazy? They come out of the woods and try and go in people's houses and stuff.
They don't even show up like the people don't. When it gets cold down there, buddy, it's cold. I rode the beach today, first time in a couple of weeks, and people were down there walking barefooted, and a lot of girls had on just jogging bras and all that stuff, and I'm bundled up in the coat. I'm moving, you know. I mean, I was moving, but wasn't many people down there at all.
Oh, so there are people that live year round on Tybee Island?
Oh yeah, yeah. Oh man, they got $1 million homes. Several million dollar, you know, like $2 or $3 million homes sitting down there on the beach.
Is that the neighborhood you live in?
I live the street behind that.
In a garage apartment. Oh.
You know, at least give them a spring for you a lot down there so you can be close to work.
They should. They don't take me. I'm like, you know, 20 minutes from that, but I'm telling you, you know, that's like everything else. When that real estate market went crazy, I mean, it exploded down there, and then it bit everybody in the rear end when it crashed.
Oh, listen, I grew up in Atlanta. I grew up in a part of Atlanta called Cabbage Town. That's where my church is now. I mean, my church is two blocks from the house I grew up in, and it's a mill village. Fulton Bag Cotton Mill was my grandfather worked in the mill 40 years. That's where he retired from. And we lived there, and I can remember when I was about 8 or 9 years old, the landlord tried to sell the house to my mother for $8,000. And we had one of the bigger houses in the neighborhood. It was not owned by the mill. It had been built by a private owner, and it had three bedrooms and a kitchen and a dining room, and I mean, it was just a huge house. And Mama said, "No, that's too much money. It's not. It's, you know, this was probably 1968,
69. $8,000 now, right?
That's what she tried to sell it to her for. Back in 1978, 79, they declared Cabbage Town a historic neighborhood.
I know where this is going.
And all the yuppies started moving in. I've been at the church. I've been back at pastoring this church for 4 years. The 17th day of February will be 4 years. The first week I was over there 4 years ago, a couple in the church said, "Show us the house you grew up in." And we rode up the street, and it happened to be an open house. It was for sale. We got out and went in. I looked around, and a young real estate agent there, you know, and I told her, I said, "Look, I'm not interested in buying." I said, "I grew up in the house." And I told her that story, and she laughed. She said, "Well, it's on sale today, and you can buy it if you want to move back in here." And I said, "How much are you asking for it?" She said, "Well, it's on sale." She said, "You can buy it today for $388,000. And I said, "How much was it before it wasn't on sale?" She said, $410,000. I called my mother. I said, "You ought to be ashamed of yourself." I said, "We could be semi-millionaires."
Bobby, what had they done to it? A heck of a lot, or?
Jerry, when I grew up in the house, it was, we had linoleum rugs.
Right.
You know, like a 10 by 10 or a 10 by 12 linoleum rug, and we would paint the floor, you know, the rug, you know, we'd paint the floor up under the rug so that it was clean and freshly painted every time you put a new rug down. And we would wax the linoleum. I mean, it was just that's the way people did over there back then. They snatched all that linoleum up, and under all of that paint and under all of that linoleum was the prettiest hardwood floors you'd ever seen in your life.
I guarantee you. Yeah, I guarantee you.
And they turned one of the bedrooms into a sitting room and a large master bath off of the bedroom, one of the bedrooms. They other than that, they didn't do a whole lot of changes to the house. They just, you know, sheetrock walls and stuff like that, but you know, it was there was a big brick fire pit they'd built out in the backyard and a patio, but other than that, they hadn't done anything to it.
No kidding.
Now I'll give you another one better than that. Next door to the house I grew up in, my grandfather had a shotgun house. My grandfather and grandmother, they bought it when my mom was 6 weeks old, and they bought it from the mill. And I can remember walking with my grandfather to the edge of downtown to make his house payments. His house payments were like $15 a month. And it was three rooms. It was a living room, a bedroom, and a kitchen. the bathroom was on the back porch, and you had to actually go out outside onto the back porch into the bathroom. They enclosed the back porch when I was a kid. I can remember when the house didn't have a water heater. You had to heat water on the stove to take a bath. And this house, I think they paid a total of $4,000 for it. They bought it from the mill where he worked, and, you know, the mill owned a lot of those houses and sold them to the people, you know, that
right.
worked there. When my grandmother and my grandfather raised four kids in that house with one bedroom in the middle. And, of course, as they all married, moved away. Well, my grandfather died about 30 years ago. About 20 years ago, my grandmother passed away. And my uncle that I was so close to, he was born in the living room of that house. And he had never lived anywhere but in that house except for 2 years he was in the Army. Well, he passed away in the living room of the house about 10 years ago.
Where he was born.
Same room. And my mother had moved back in after my grandmother died to help keep the house going and to take care of my uncle a little bit. And I told her, I said, you really don't need to stay here by yourself. Y'all need to sell the house. She has a sister and a brother left. Some guy came along and offered her $29,000 cash for it. And they sold it. I mean, they like to broke this guy's arm taking it. About a month after they did that is when this thing went crazy over there in that neighborhood. That house has sold twice in the last 10 years. The last time that three-room house sold, it sold for $210,000.
Well, you don't ever go around any of your kin people again for telling them to sell it, do you? I mean,
geez. Well, no, they did the right thing. And you know, if they'd have held on to it, who knows? But, I mean, it's absolutely crazy over there, the cost of those houses. And because it's a historic district, they tell the people what color they can paint them. They tell them what kind of doors they can put. I mean, you can't do anything without
that.
The city saying it's okay.
Man.
Doesn't Randy still have a house there, Bobby?
Randy owns two houses over there. He owns one. He owns one. It's a very small house. It's only a living room, a bedroom, and a bathroom. And he rents it out, and then he has a house that's it's a two- or three-bedroom house that he has that he rents out as well. But he bought those for almost nothing, you know, and then it went crazy. And, of course, now the value has, I mean, as far as being able to sell them, they've devalued them so bad here lately. That you couldn't get the big bucks for him right now, but you know Randy's content just to rent him out and let people live in him and send him a check.
It's so mailbox money. Well, guys, our guest has called in. I'm gonna get him on the line. Our special guest tonight is going to be Scott Till. We're going to do a little bit of follow up on the show we did last week about wrestling publications and whatnot, and I wanted to follow that up into talking about the internet and all the different websites that are out there dedicated to pro wrestling in general, but they're a lot still dedicated to the old territories. So let me get Scott on the line with us, and we'll proceed from there. Hello, Mr. Till. How are you this evening?
Well, hey, Mike, how are you today?
Oh, other than feeling like warmed over death, I'm all right.
Hi, Bobby. Hi, Jerry.
Hey, Scott. I'm mad at Scott. I sent him a very rare photo, and he hadn't even responded to me.
I saw that, and I meant to do that.
If I'm here in March, I'm going to get him to autograph.
It's sitting on my kitchen counter for everybody to see.
I'm going to put it up on the wall down there at the reunion.
That's right. Hey, I want y'all to know that when I was a kid, we used to live in an oversized paper bag in the middle of Interstate 65. We really had it bad. Oh, man. Hey, I want y'all to weigh in on something before we get started. I got a list of promoters. And I want y'all to tell me whether you think they're good, I mean, great promoters or not. Or they really knew what they were doing. Now, I'm not talking about whether you liked them or whether, you know, what kind of person they were, but whether they're good wrestling promoters. And if y'all just say yes or no, that would, I'm going to keep a record of it and add it to my poll that I'm doing. You probably answer, just go in order, Mike, Jerry, and then Bobby. That way we do it quick. Okay, Vince McMahon Sr.
Yes.
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 Vince McMahon Jr.
Good promoter. I guess because of his success, I'd have to say yes.
All right.
In that aspect, I'd have to say yes.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about, as far as promoting wrestling.
I'd say yes, too. He's very successful at what he does.
Jim Crockett Sr., Charlotte?
Yes.
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 Jim Crockett Jr.?
No.
Uh-oh.
I would say yes, but he was led astray. But yes, when he was up, when I was up there, they did a wonderful job.
All right.
I'd say yes, too.
All right, Jim Barnett?
Yes.
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 Tom Pack in St. Louis? He was before Sam Muchnick.
Yeah. I don't really know enough about him to answer, but I'm going to say yes.
I don't either, and I'd have to agree with you there, Mike. I really didn't even know who the promoter was before Sam, but...
Yeah.
For the shape the town was always in, and I would have to say yes.
All right.
I'm in the same boat. I didn't know him, but...
All right. How about Sam Muchnick?
Yes.
Definite yes.
Yes.
All right. Nick Gulas?
Yes.
I'd have to say yes.
I'd say yes.
Eddie Quinn? Did y'all know Eddie Quinn up in Montreal?
I did not.
He had part of Boston there for a while, wasn't he? And he was also involved with Fred Fuller in Chicago, so yeah, I'd say yes.
Okay.
It would be hard for me to say, but evidently from everything I've always heard about this conditions of those territories, I would have to say yes. Me knowing,
Yeah, I didn't know him.
Okay. And Dean Silverstone up in Seattle.
Yes.
Jerry, you may not know Dean that well.
I really don't. I don't know. Did he do that before Don had Seattle or was with Don? Or?
Mainly Washington.
No, I know that.
Yeah, it was after Don.
Yeah.
I would have to say yes.
Okay.
I'd say yes.
All right. All right, I'll give you all the results later once I tally everything up and let you know what I'm doing with it. I just want to cover something before we get into something. Last week something was said that sort of bothered me, and it was talking about Bobby, you told a story about a wrestler at one of the reunions, and he showed really a lot of disrespect and disdain for some of the wrestling historians and the fans, the old time fans that were there, by not refusing to talk to them, because he said he didn't feel like they were in the business, so he wasn't going to talk around them. And he said the reason he doesn't talk around them a lot is because they act like they know. Well, the quote was, "They know what's going on in our business. They think they know, but they're never in the ring." And I just don't agree with that. I think people. It's like saying Howard Cosell couldn't commentate boxing because he had never been a boxer. And going back, I'll tell you right now, the reason I asked about those promoters, when you look at that list, Vince McMahon Sr., Jr., Jim Crockett Sr., Jack Curley, Pfeffer, Jim Barnett, Tom Pax, Sam Muchnick, Nick Gulas, Eddie Quinn, and Dean Silverstone, not a one of those guys have ever been in the ring as a wrestler. And so that, to me, right there points to the fallacy. To me, it's just a dumb argument, for people to say something like that. That sort of bothered me that the wrestling historians and some of the old-time fans who study the business today, are put down like they are because, they have a lot of knowledge and they've studied. It's like a race car. Gordon Solie shouldn't be allowed to, commentate on race cars, and he did. He was a great race car person, but... He shouldn't be allowed to because he never raced a car. Well, that's just not right. you know. So I don't know how, if y'all weighed on in on that after that segment or not. I hadn't heard anything else, but it just, I don't know, it just sort of stepped on with me.
Well, that happened at one of my little deals there that I was that I have at the church, and
yeah.
it was Bobby Fields. He was the one that made the statement, and you know, I think the statement came from many years in the business, and just not the reality of the business is 25 years ago, if I had, or 35 years ago. If I had said anything to somebody outside the realm of the business, no matter what they were, if they were not physically in the ring, you know, I mean, that was dangerous territory. You know, fingers broke, accidentally stepping on your arm or your head. But times have changed. And, you know, I didn't agree with it, with the statement as it was made. But I respected his opinion anyway.
It's like my father-in-law over here in Savannah promoted wrestling and all the whole east coast of Georgia over here, and he had never stepped in a ring. But
yeah,
I understand what Bobby was saying, what Phil said. It was just a protection of our business at the time. I mean,
yeah,
and I know things change, you know. I don't know how long ago that took place, but, you know, the old-timers, you know, even Thea's still protected it. At the end, you know, I mean, but just because somebody never stepped foot in the ring, now I don't agree with that.
Right, but that's the way it's
just it. Like, you know, there were a lot of great guys that promoted our business that never wrestled, but did protect it. I mean, I see that aspect of it, you know.
Yes. Yeah, and I can respect what Bobby, I tried not to use Bobby's name because I wasn't trying to dog him. But since Bobby,
right. We used to him getting dogged.
we're weekly getting in trouble for something, so you know. That's...
Oh, I'm sure.
Well, one thing about that, and I see both sides of it, and it kind of leads into what I wanted to talk about tonight with the internet. Since the rise of the internet, and this is not talking about the Jim Melbys, the Scott Teals, the Steve Yohees, the historians, who study the business and look at it more in depth as to, you know, than the casual fans. But
let me stop you right there. The names you just mentioned, though, respect what we did.
Right.
Exactly.
That's the line that I think I draw there, Scott. I mean, I don't know if you agree with that, but, you know,
instead
of slamming what we did, you know,
exactly.
You just...
It's the ones who are on the internet now who, you know, were born in 1983. They think, you know, didn't know that wrestling existed before Hulk Hogan.
Yeah.
And, you know, they look at old tapes and stuff, and they say, oh, man, you know, just to grab a name out of the hat, Frankie Williams up in New York. Oh, man, he was a bum. You know,
yeah.
He couldn't win a match. You know, hey, wait a minute. You know, do you call a stuntman who takes all the bumps in a movie a bum because he gets killed in every movie? That was his role. That's where I come up with the you've never been in the ring, you don't understand part of it. And
yeah.
I know, but some people are, you know, I know a lot of wrestlers, when Kayfabe Memories was first put together in the early 2000s, a lot of the boys went there. Because it was, you know, a way to connect with the old fans. Round about after the first crash and they brought it back up, you know, we seem to have gotten a lot of the younger guys on there, and they just dogged people.
Yeah.
You know, Ole Anderson, how bitter he is, and he just grouchy. You know, I don't understand. You know, people don't understand everything that's involved. All they see is what's on the surface, and they... You know, they think they know everything, and those are the types of ones that bother me.
Yes, I Cauliflower Alley Club. One year, we did the historians forum, and they had four or five of us up there that people asked questions of. And shortly before I went to that Cauliflower Alley Club event, someone online had posted a. You remember the old cards they used to have in the advertisements they used to have in the newspapers? I mean, I love to get up on Sunday morning and run outside, get the newspaper, because they had the lineup, you know, for the wrestling for the following week. And they always had that box, you know, that had a few pictures of the wrestlers' heads, and then they had the lineup. They posted one in there from, it was probably around 65. The match was Lou Thesz against Mike Padoucis in Miami Beach, main event. Might have been a world title match. And some clown got on there and he says, oh, I'll bet that was a, I mean, real smart, Alec, you know. Oh, I'll bet that was a real exciting main event. Mike Padoucis, oh, wow. You know, he went on and on. And that really bothered me. You know what? Mike Padoucis may have been an underneath wrestler for a lot of his career, but even the underneath wrestlers back then were good. I mean, I remember Pete Gomez. He never won a match in Tampa on television. Never. I think he's probably lost more matches than any other wrestler I've ever seen. But he was always, you know, he would wrestle Jack Briscoe at the Tampa Sportatorium, which, you know, was on television. And there was always that wonder in your mind back there, he just might win this. Of course, part of that was due to Jack. You know, right. Jack Briscoe was a good hand. You know? But at the same time, these guys were good. I don't care where they were on the card. And for a fan who had never been in the business, who, like you said, Mike probably was born in 1985, didn't know anything but Hulk Hogan, to make a statement, an arrogant statement like, oh, yeah, I'll bet that was real exciting. Mike Padoucis, oh, wow. I mean, that was just totally off the cuff. And I'm with you there. That just, it bothers me. It bothers me when these guys mock these guys for their, you know, that, oh, their work rate's no good. They don't do this. I just, you know, I come on there. Go ahead.
What is work rate? What is a move set?
Yeah.
These invented terms for, you know,
yep.
You know, I just don't understand. And, you know, people that look at, you know, they see, can't watch a match with Vern Gagne in it without thinking, well, he killed his territory because he wouldn't keep Hulk Hogan.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, that was the last year of his, of a 40-year career. What about the other 39 years of it, you know?
Yeah.
Well, this is something else, too, that you guys can appreciate, but a lot of these guys don't. In the era that we're talking about, in the 60s, in the 70s to some degree, most of the 70s, for the time I was in the business, these guys that never won a match, these guys that people looked at that, oh, well, you know, they're bums, they, you know, who are they? Most of those guys could reach down your throat and pull your lungs out through your ears.
Exactly.
And you're right, they were playing a role, they were playing a part. You know, Steinborn uses the term carpenter. They built what was going to happen later in the night. And you know, it was look at Bunk Harris. Bunk Harris was probably one of the guys that I remember as a kid going to the matches. You know, he didn't win a lot of matches, but what a worker he was.
Yes.
And you know, he just, it was a, I got to know him after he had retired, and of course met him down in Mobile. I would sit and listen to him because he amazed me at the stories he told.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, yeah, it bothers me. These guys, you know, some of these guys today, you know, and even Dale said it about Hogan. He said he don't know a wrist lock from a wristwatch.
Yeah.
And he just, you know, that's all. But that's all people know now.
Let me throw a name out there, Bobby, that's the epitome of what you just said, of a guy that probably never won a whole lot of matches. And Scott will know who it is when I throw his name out. But if anybody crossed him, and I don't care if it's the main event guy on the card, they crossed him, they're going to get hurt. Rick Carter. You know what I'm talking about, Scott?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Who did you say, Michael? I missed it.
Rick Connor.
Sure.
Worked around Knoxville. I don't know if he ever worked anywhere but around Knoxville.
I'll give you another one, and the guy looked like a bum. George McCreary.
Yep.
Yes.
I was just thinking him, too.
He was like an all-Army champion or something, and he was, I mean, he looked like some guy off the street.
You remember his finishing hole, don't you, Bobby?
The one where he fell flat on his back and looked up at the lights.
His shoulder.
Yeah.
He's the one that did that.
The first time I ever met him was at Atlanta TV. Gary Hart was the assistant booker, and George come in the dressing room, and, you know, I'd never seen him, didn't know who he was. And Gary was like all over him, and he said, Georgie, make yourself at home. And I'll never forget, he opened his bag up, and there's no telling what all he had in that bag. He started throwing things, hanging them off lamps and off the ceiling, and he finally, when he had everything threw out all over the floor, he plopped down on the couch and he said, "Okay, I'm at home now." Funny guy. Funny guy.
Yeah, I agree with you.
But I don't care for the modern thing. I mean, you know, granted, I've made a New Year's resolution. You know, I may not watch today's product and all that stuff, but, I mean, us going on and complaining about it is like saying that, you know, movies quit being good after the Marx Brothers, you know. The movie business changes, the wrestling business changes. You know, I can enjoy a W.C. Fields movie or a Buster Keaton movie, and I can turn around and enjoy Avatar. You know what I mean? So it's just, I don't watch a lot of today's stuff. I mean, every time I turn it on, it just doesn't appeal to me. But that doesn't mean, you know, that the guys aren't talented. It doesn't mean that it's not what it is. You know, and it's for the most part, it's successful. So
that's something that I had to really come to terms with, Mike, is for the longest time, you know, like all the guys, you know, that go way back, I used to complain about it. I said, you know, Vince really destroyed the business. But you know what? It's a different world. I don't like it. I don't watch it. I haven't watched it since really 1983, 84, when it got ridiculous. The stuff they were doing on WCW in 84, the guys in the 50s would have been just as upset about it as we are about what happened to it after 1980. But I used to think, you know, I used to say, you know, Vince has really done this, done that to the business. But you know what? Vince did what was right for Vince McMahon, and I can't fault him for that. I mean, he's a billionaire now. Look at the money that guy's got. You know, he's doing what's good for business, what's good for him. So I'm not going to knock that. I don't like it. I don't watch it. But that doesn't mean I'm going to go around and knock it and you know, constantly saying how bad it is.
You give the devil a due. He has been more successful. He's made it more mainstream now.
I can give you a perfect example of when Dickie was training me in Orlando. He'd worked with me quite a bit, so we'd gone down to Milo's gym, and it was a Sunday night. And so Dickie said, my dad knows we're down here. He said, he'll be down here in a little bit. So I'd only been in the ring in that gym a few times, so his dad come down, and he said, all right, Daddy, he said, I want you to watch, see how Jerry's coming along. So we did a pretty long spot, and boom, 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 boom. Did it, and boom. Dickie said, that was good. He said, Daddy, he said, what do you think? He said, too mechanical.
Wow.
You know, they used to work a headlock for 30 minutes. But I was to see a match of those guys, I wouldn't knock it because I know it's changed. But the change from, like you just said, Scott, you know, when it, even like WCW, you know, when I just, I don't know, you know, when you know, they get out there and they cuss on TV and they got, you know, the stuff. And I still, you know, I have grandkids and some of the stuff that Vince was doing later on, I mean, I just, it was too much even for me, you know, and I just, that was my rub with it, you know, it was just too much, you know. I mean,
it's just way off the chart compared to what everybody else, what wrestling.
Right, right. I mean, and you know, but there's an old saying: how do you knock success? You know, I mean, I know things change, everything changes, but you know, it was just, even today, you know, I mean, even when Austin was up there, it was entertaining to me. The guy worked hard. I mean, you know, I didn't care about all the beer and the fingers and he would do, you know. But as far as his hard work and what he did, I mean, you can't knock that. I mean, I thought he was the best thing they ever had, including Hogan.
Yeah.
That's my opinion, you know.
Absolutely.
Because he did work hard. I mean, he worked. I mean, I give him all the credit for what he did. I just wasn't into, you know,
what he was doing.
The beer drinking out there, and it makes you look like, you know, you're just nothing but a lush that can wrestle. I don't know. I always tried to separate the two, you know, but I guess I'm.
That's a good point when you talk about the beer drinking. That's part of, well, I mean, I quit watching wrestling long before that, so I can't say that, you know, that bothered me to get me out of it. But you know, it to me, it just wasn't a good example for children. Nick Gulas, you can say what you want, but he presented a family product. He didn't allow the wrestlers to curse, even standing outside the dressing room, around the arena, you know, when there's fans around. He was very, very careful about what he allowed the wrestlers to portray. And, I mean, of course, then Nick would let out a blast of curse words himself around the fans. But, you know, for the most part, you know, he presented a good family show. You could take your kids to a Nick Gulas Roy Welch show, never have to worry about what they saw, you know, but the lewd gestures or, you know, people shooting birds or curse words or anything
like
that.
Even when I was running there in Columbus, not that far back, you know, I tried to run it in a respectful, family-oriented thing because I live there. And,
yeah.
I, you know, I couldn't have girls out there with their breasts hanging out and their fannies hanging out, and maybe I should have. I don't know. But I couldn't do it. That wasn't me. And, I lived in that town. Everybody knew who I was, and I just couldn't go out there and say, my God, did you see what Jerry Oates is doing out there? And was I wrong? Maybe I was. I don't know. But I thought I was right. But and amazing, you get up there in the dressing room and the guy, and I always tried to use the best that I could get. I mean, you know, and we had some really talented guys, and I was dumbfounded that they didn't know, they couldn't speak Carney, they didn't know this, they didn't know that. I would say, you're on Second, and how about, you know, could you go Broadway? Like, what?
What? Oh, my God.
I mean, guys had been around for a while, and I'm going, my gosh. I guess they thought I was Hackenschmidt in there talking to them or something, you know? they didn't. I mean, really, guys? I mean, I was dumbfounded. I couldn't believe. I don't know.
The only thing they got right in this whole new deal is they kicked Charlie Smith out of the dressing room. One time.
Listen, I was just sitting here thinking, you're talking about Broadway. Charlie was doing the ring announcing one time, and he got up in the ring. I don't even remember if he got in the ring or he was on stage or whatever, but he was announcing. He said, ladies and gentlemen, this is your first match of the evening. It'll be one fall and 15-minute Broadway.
Well, I think he could have got by with that because the guys that was in the ring probably didn't know what he was talking about.
Tinker Todd once told me that Bill Lewis, back the old promoter in Richmond, you know, back in the Jim Crockett Senior days. I don't know if you ever met him, Jerry.
That's the one gave the pony away every year.
You what?
Is that the one gave the pony away every year?
It was, absolutely. He got in the ring one night. They were planning that they had a match between Tinker and somebody else in Richmond, and the winner was going to wrestle Anthony Naraka the following week. They were bringing in Naraka as a special attraction. And Bill Lewis got up in the ring and he says, the winner of this match will wrestle Anthony Naraka next week. Next week, Tinker Todd will wrestle Anthony Naraka. That's a true story.
I believe it.
Who was it? Was it Chico Cortez that was announcing Tex Riley was having a loser leave town match against somebody, and he announced this was the last chance.
Oh yeah, get your pictures. Last chance. He's leaving for Japan tomorrow or something. Yeah.
Oh, what a classic!
Could you imagine what our business would have been like back when we were all involved in it with the internet?
Stuff like that happening.
Oh,
absolutely, exactly right. That's why people, you know, they always have the question, do you think wrestling will ever come back and be to the territory days, be the way it was? And I always say, absolutely not, because you can never, ever again make the business a believable business and make people believe what you're doing. And that's what you've got to have to run a territory, to run a town every single week, or at least even every other week. You just can't do it without that kayfabe. And with the internet, there's just no way.
Oh, it's a done deal. You're right.
Yeah, it's well, a booker, as smart as a booker would be, and we talk about this all the time about the people that we worked for and we knew that were such smart manipulators of our business that would could there's no way. I mean, you can't, if you do something in Augusta tonight, it's going to beat you back to Atlanta.
Yes.
So, I mean, there's no way to manipulate something new every night. And you know, and back, you know, and we, of course, we bicycle those tapes. So whatever angle we shot in Atlanta, we bicycle that tape through Augusta and Savannah, and that angle kind of followed the tape. I mean, that's history. There's no way to do it.
And that tape would be shown for 2-3 weeks by the time. By the time it was in the last town, it might be 3 weeks later.
Right. Right.
Absolutely. Yep. I thought somebody else was a good wrestler that I think people don't give enough credit to, and y'all talked about him for it, and Bobby, you'll know who I'm talking about when I mention who he trained, but this guy, you know, for most part, most people, just he's a footnote in wrestling history, but he, you know, he had made his mark in wrestling, but he trained Tom Renesto for one. You know who I'm talking about?
The Spaceman.
Spaceman Frank Hickey, absolutely.
Frank Hickey.
Absolutely.
Well, you know, there again,
our
buddy Ted Allen.
Exactly.
You know, Ted Allen never made it huge as far as being a name in the business, being a top star. But look at all the people he trained and his legacy. That's, you know.
Absolutely.
I mean, Arn Anderson, the Big Boss Man.
Yep. Absolutely.
Just, if we could turn the clock back, gentlemen, I'd pack my bag tomorrow.
I don't know if I could, Bobby.
Well, you're sick tonight. You couldn't pack your bag. We'd have to go get you ready.
Yeah, geez.
Let me get your guys' take on this. This is something else that's been bounced around the internet this week on a couple of sites. And I don't know. I guess they showed it on one of the WWE roundtables because it's a YouTube clip, but it's got the WWE 24/7 logo on the corner of it. But it's from Florida, probably, I don't know, 73, 74, somewhere in that. And it's it's shot at the TV studio there on Albany. And Eddie Graham is standing outside the ring, and Bob Roop is in there with a guy who evidently claimed he was a wrestler or could wrestle or whatever. And Bob stretched him.
Yeah.
He's making the guy holler. And
yeah.
He's talking to him, you know, he's got the sugar hold on him. He's telling me, okay, you want to be a wrestler? You claim to be a wrestler and all this stuff. So many people came down on Roop because of that. Saying, well, you know, he was picking on this poor guy, all this stuff, and I thought, oh, you know, wait a minute, guys. I mean, that's how we protected the business back then.
Yeah.
You know, this guy, from the backstory on that, is I think the guy was trained by Ronnie Hill. Ronnie Hill at the time was trying to run opposition to Graham. He was going on the radio and telling people, you know, we're real wrestlers over here, and what Graham does is not real, and all that stuff. And you know, Ronnie Hill had a reputation of doing stuff like that. He did it several different places. But so Roop just evidently this was one of Hill's guys, and how they got into the TV studio, I don't know. But he basically, you know, taught the guy not to run his mouth. And you know, people were, you know, why did he do that? You know, wrestling is fake. You know, he shouldn't have been doing it. It's like, yeah, but you know, you have to understand back in those days. That was our mindset. That's how we protected the business. That's like you couldn't take your car to a mechanic and say, oh, you just step aside and let me get in here and work on it, or let me work on this car over here. You know, this was how these guys made a living, and they were protecting their business.
Well, I witnessed that in Tampa. The first time I ever wrestled on TV anywhere ever was in Tampa, Florida on a Wednesday. So I go from Orlando to Tampa, and I get there, and I pull up, and there's a guy in the parking lot. I thought he'd been in a wreck on Del Mabry. I mean, he was, my gosh, he had blood all over him and this and that. My gosh. So I got in, I said, who's that guy that's that? Oh, he's one of those guys that said he was a wrestler and come down here to work out.
Oh.
They
they used to do it every Wednesday before TV. I mean,
oh yeah.
Oh my gosh.
It was Monday at the Sports Arena in Atlanta. When I first, I had worked for Ann Dunkel for 2 years, and when we went out of business, when we closed, as I, you know, the good Lord blessed me, out of 32 wrestlers and referees, I was the only one that walked out of Dunkel and walked into Georgia Championship with a job on Monday. And I met Barnett. I mean, I had met Barnett on Saturday, but I went over to the office, and he invited me back and talked to me, and he introduced me to Harley, and Harley was a booker. And I'd heard stories about Harley, but I'd never met him, you know, and Harley was as nice to me as, you know, as he could be. And, you know, Mr. Ward had put the word out. He didn't want to use me because I'd worked for the opposition and blah, 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 you know, and it didn't matter that Fred had ran opposition, you know, to Paul Jones. But anyway, I was a bad guy. He didn't want to use me. And Harley's relaying the story to me about how he used to haul Happy Humphrey around and he had trouble getting into business and blah, 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 you know, nice as he could be. Well, when we get through with the discussion and he tells me where I'm working that week, he says, come on, let's go down and watch him work out. And we go down in the arena. And they had a couple of guys in the ring, and it was a bloodletting. I mean, it was awful. And I'm sitting there thinking to myself, God, please tell me they're not going to ask me to work out. You know, I mean, it was awful. But that was every Monday. Monday that went on. And
the side note of the Bob Roop thing, Mike, the guys back then, I mean, it was tough to make a living in the wrestling business. And you had to do back then, I mean, it was almost like a fiefdom, every territory. The promoters had absolute say over everything. You could barely argue about anything. And Jerry, I mean, Jerry, all y'all know this, you know. If Eddie Graham told Bob Roop to stretch those guys, if Bob wanted the job, he had to do that. You know, he didn't have any choice. Where's he going to go?
And that's exactly what took place. I was down there. That's what Eddie wanted. That's what Eddie got. Whether it's right, whether it's wrong, Bob, you know, Bob had the credentials, and that was the deal. You're absolutely right, Scott.
Yep.
Every territory back then, too, Jerry, had one or two guys that were legitimate, dangerous human beings.
Oh,
and they were the policemen, you know.
That's what people today don't understand is how closed our business was. You couldn't take a guy in there that's straight off the street, whether, you know, he claimed to have been trained or whatever. You couldn't take a guy straight off the street and say, okay, we're going to work a match. What's the first thing he's going to do? He's going to go to the nearest bar. He's going to run his mouth. And these people had to make a living in that town. They had to draw money, and they drew money by the fact that they presented it as real. And that's what people don't understand today, because it's so open. Everybody knows that it's a work. You know, everybody knows the insider terms. They know what a baby face is. They know what a heel is. And they feel big by using all these insider terms and stuff like that. But they don't understand why Rude just didn't take this guy in and say, okay, here, when I do this, I'm going to drop down and you jump over me and I'm going to grab a headlock. And you know, that's just not the way it was. I got stretched my first time in the ring. Don't think I didn't. I had Matt Burns on my nose for weeks. But, you know, that's how you weed out the people who were going to get into the business and protect the business versus the ones who were just going to go down there, try it out, quit the next day, and then go tell all their friends. You know?
Well, I don't understand, and Scott, since, you know, you're so knowledgeable of everything that's gone down through the years, and you know more history about what I did than I do, but what I don't understand is when Vince really kind of opened the door to everything, as Stez told me one time, the broom's out of the closet, how he could still draw. I mean, what would make anybody want to watch it? I mean,
I have said the exact same thing, Jerry, over and why would anybody pay $15, $20 when they know what's going to happen?
That's my thing.
I think that's where, and that's where, give the devil his due, that's where he's gotten smart. You know, he's let everybody know it's a work, but it's still, it's such a spectacle
Yeah.
You know, it's just, and I keep harkening back and comparing it to the movies. You know when you go see a John Wayne movie, 9 times out of 10, John Wayne is not going to die in the movie, so you know how the movie is going to end. But still, you're entertained by it because you're able to, we claim that you know, back in our day, that we were able to get people to suspend, reality and everything. And I guess in a way he does too, because people know, who's going to win, but they're into it. And I think the biggest thing he's done is he's made it such an audience participation type thing. I mean, because if you watch their shows, they're not watching what's going on in the ring. They're looking at the Jumbotron to see, who's doing what, and if they're on there, and, who's coming out of the dressing room now and all that stuff. So he's totally gotten away from the believability of it, and he still draws. And he draws, he re-educated those young kids. He started with Hogan, making Hogan a Superman, and he drew in the little kids who've now grown up and are now adults and who still follow it and still love it. While those of us who were adults when all this started happening, we loved what we watched. And it's like, wait, I can't believe it. Everybody up there, Junkyard Dog, who, when I saw him in Louisiana, he was the baddest thing on 2 feet. Now he's up there dancing and singing Grab Them Cakes. And I said, wait a minute. But I guarantee you, he drew more money, working for Vince. But, I don't know. So I think in a way he re-educated people, and it is what it is now. And that's why, they go to be part of the spectacle. They don't go to worry about who's going to win what. Because, their titles don't mean anything.
But he did get the guys that were the superstars for the NWA. When they went to work for him, he got them, though. He turned Dusty into Pizza Delivery Man. He had Harley out there with a crown, and I asked Harley about it one time. He said, it made me sick to do that. He said, what was I going to do?
There you go. Even you're still the same. Nothing's changed. You got to do what you tell you to do, or you don't work.
I can see that. Turn Terry Taylor into a Red Rooster, and
But look at what else you got to help himself. Back when we were in the business, if you had a territory, say, let's say Florida, for example, when Dusty was hot, if Dusty decided to hold up ground for more money or walk out, he'd affect the business. McMahon didn't have that problem. Yeah, he's got some stars that are bigger than others, and he pushes more than he does others, but you think if John Cena quit tomorrow, his business would suffer? No, because he sells the brand. He doesn't sell the individual. That's where he's different from where the old territory is. In Kansas City, Harley was always the top dog. Florida, it was Dusty. In Georgia, it was Wrestling 2, Tommy Rich, Tony Atlas. He had that upper echelon of guys, and that's who people drew, to go see. Vince doesn't worry about what's going to draw as far as whether John Cena versus CM Punk is going to draw. WWE draws. That's it. That's what draws you. It doesn't matter whether the guy's all on the card or who's on the card. That brand is what draws. And he's smart to do that.
Evidently. This is kind of off of what we're really talking about right now, but is Flair still up there with TNA?
Yeah, I think he's either under contract with them or his contract's about to expire, because I think I think they just announced that the Four Horsemen are going into the WWE Hall of Fame. So without him, so even though Ole, they're not doing Ole. They're doing Tully, Arn, Barry Windham, and Flair, and Dylan.
JJ emailed me the other night. He says, if you can stomach it, watch Raw tonight. Of course, that was like 10:30 when I was getting ready to go to work. It was already off, but I was really surprised. I'm glad to see it. I really am.
I wish
it was over. Yeah, but I don't think Vince will ask him, because Vince, like Ole said in his book, you know, Vince told him one time, "You'll never ever, you know, work for me again," and it's because of what Ole said to Vince's wife. You know, he told her, whatever.
And we all know Ole. If they offered, he would accept it. He's that stubborn. So, and he didn't like the Four Horsemen deal anyway. He thought it was dumb thing. Yeah. So,
I have people all the time ask me why he didn't talk more about the Four Horsemen in the book. He had nothing to say about it. I asked him a bunch of times.
Well, wait a minute. Whose idea was that?
It just happened. Arn did a interview on TV one day, and he says something about you. They had the four of them up there, or five of them, and he says, "You've got the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse up here." I guess, you know, just took something from the Bible, and somehow somebody picked up on that and says, you know, I don't know if they got letters or people were saying something, but somebody picked up on it. You know, we need to run with this.
A lot of people there, you know, and people don't believe me when I tell them, but, you know, that was not a new idea. If I could figure out who would have been, was working with WCW that had ties to the Gulf Coast in 1974, I could tell you where the idea came from. For just about the whole year of 74, Duke Miller was the Gulf Coast champion here, and he had three guys with him. He had the Pro, he had Billy Spears, he had Gorgeous George Jr. They had a faction called Murder Incorporated. And the whole thing was, whenever Miller was defending his title, if he got in trouble, they ran in help, just like the Horsemen did. And
never heard that.
The whole thing. But I don't know who would have been, I mean, because Hayes was in a position of power with the WCW when the Horseman idea came about, so I don't know. He and Percy are the only two that I can think of that were even in the business around back when that was actually happening.
One thing we do know, it wasn't Jim Herd. That guy never had an idea in his life.
Oh.
Well, I didn't know that about the deal in Mobile with Duke Miller. Mike.
Yeah. And that's when the Four Horsemen started, all that started happening, I was thinking, wow, you know, this looks familiar. Maybe Dusty knew about it. I don't know. But because I think he was booking for Rock at the time all that came about. But, the whole thing wound up, over several weeks, and they wound up with a big street fight. There again, a bunkhouse brawl in Mobile with everybody in their street clothes. It was the four of them against Bob Kelly, Mike Boyette, Tony Gonzalez, who had quit wearing the mask. He was just Tony Gonzalez at that time, even though everybody knew he was the medic. Jerry's favorite person, Sweet Daddy Watts.
Cool.
And they all had a big street fight.
Did you remember him, Jerry?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Did you get those pictures I sent you?
Yes. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I was telling Jeff about him doing the Abdul the Butcher gimmick here.
Is he still living?
I have no clue.
I don't know. It's funny how, you know, we're talking about old stuff. Let me give you all a little story here that happened last night, which I on Wednesday nights, a lot of times I get to the church early, and I've got in my study at the church, I got a sofa in there and a TV, and I turned the TV on and laid down on the sofa, and I went to sleep. And one of the young ladies from the church came back, knocked on the door, and she came in, and I've got some pictures hanging on the wall of different things from the wrestling business, and she sent a picture of Dusty that I've got up on the wall in a match I did somewhere. Anyway, she said that brings back a great memory of my little brother. She said, "I remember one time Dusty Rhodes," she said, "the Andersons, or one of the Andersons and a Russian guy beat him up on the side of the road." And I said, "Do what?" And she goes, "Yes." She said, "They beat him up on the side of the road, and he was late getting to the matches, and he come charging in the side door." And he said, "My little brother was standing there, and he said he had his program, and said he come through the door, and he was bloody, and his clothes were tore up, and he said he just he said my little brother kind of handed out a program like you might sign an autograph, and he said he just brushed my little brother out of the way, and ran to the ring, and said he left a bloody handprint on that program. And I sat there and I got to laughing. That was the night we did the deal where we started announcing at 8:30 that Dusty hadn't showed up. And I'm sitting there listening to her tell this story, and she's making it so believable that, you know, this was what happened, and he was bloody and beat up. That's the night I picked him up at the airport, and we were across the street in a parking lot, you know, and it was dark over there. And we got outside the car, and we ripped his clothes up, and we had bloodied him up, and he was rolling in the mud in the parking lot, you know. And we were just being so very careful to get everything done because we knew right at 9:55 he had to hit the door. And while we're there and we get through, he's going, well, how do I look? And we heard something, and we looked up. And right beside the parking lot was the headquarters for the City of Atlanta Fire Department. And standing up on the balcony was four firemen watching everything we did. I thought, oh, well.
That's just to tell you what a coincidence that is, that whole match that I just told you about. They called it a California Rumble match, a big street fight they had here in Mobile between Murder Incorporated and those four guys. How that came about was they were supposed to have a match on TV with Mike Boyette and Tony Gonzalez against Miller and the Pro. Well, Miller never, he was like Bobby Shane. He never worked on TV. He said if you want to see him, you had to pay money and come to the arena, and he was the champion and everything. Well, Gonzalez wasn't there. So this was at the old TV studio on Channel 3 on Mobile Highway over in Pensacola. This big beating noise and everything, and they open the door, and Tony Gonzalez falls in, and he's all bloody and everything. Well, supposedly they'd stopped him on the street and beat him up and everything to keep him from coming there. And for those of you who only know Mike Boyette for losing 142 matches working for Bill Watts or, you know, doing jobs all over the country, Mike Boyette was probably one of the most awesome interviewers as far as cutting a promotion. A lot of what Mick Foley was during his Cactus Jack persona reminded me a lot of Boyette, that intensity, but also, you know, even though he was a babyface, he would legitimately, you look at him, think he was crazy. And that's where they came up with the idea of the four of them fighting in street clothes, because of that, Gonzalez supposedly getting beat up at the parking lot. Boyette said, if you guys want to fight in the streets, we'll fight in the streets, and that's how that whole thing came about, so...
Wow.
There's only about a dozen interview or ideas in the wrestling business. You just keep recycling them.
That's true.
Adding to them.
Going back to the Eddie Graham, the Bob Roop deal, you know, the thing, there was a couple things that bothered me about that is that there was guys that come into the office, and this Georgia did it too, just because they wanted to get into the wrestling business. And you can't blame a guy for wanting to get in the wrestling business. You know, you get on, watch it on TV, and you get excited, and you think, man, you'd love to be a part of that. I mean, that's how I was. Of course, I had never had any desire to be anything other than to write about it. That's all I ever wanted to do. I never had any kind of desire to be a wrestler, referee, anything. But they'd get in there, and then they'd take them and stretch them, and it was like, They held it against them just because they came in there and asked, you know, and it wasn't so much the stretch. And yeah, they can go in there and Bob Roop can stretch the guy a little bit, but the problem, and Jerry, I don't know if you saw this or not, but after Bob Roop or whoever would stretch the guy and get him screaming, the guy would get out of the ring, and Eddie Graham would walk around and clock him. I mean, just deck him. You know, he did the line strike.
That was for real. That was the truth.
Yeah, that I don't agree with.
That was totally wrong.
Well, you know, when I wanted to get in the business, you know, Dickie was living in Orlando, and I was living in Columbus, and him and my sister were home for Christmas, and I told Dickie, I said, look, man, I want to start wrestling. He said, really? He said, how's that going to work? He said, I said, I want you to train me. He said, well, I live in Orlando, and you live in Columbus. And he said, let me ask you something. And I'll never forget this. He says, what do you have to offer the wrestling business?
Wow.
And I was stuck for an answer, you know, like, He said, you don't have the best body. You know, you're not a great amateur, you know. He said, can you beat Jack Briscoe? I said, well, I doubt it. You know, I didn't know the deal with Briscoe. I said, I doubt it, and I still doubt it. Even I had a family member, and it wasn't just like, oh, okay, I'll train you to wrestle. You know, it didn't work that way. And I moved down there, and I got down there, and I was there, you know, a couple of weeks, and I said, when are we going to start working out and training? He said, when I'm ready. He wanted to see if I was going to stay in Orlando, if I really wanted to do it.
Wow.
You know, that's the way it worked. I mean, it just, oh, okay, I'll train you. Sure, come on down. I'll teach you to be a wrestler. It didn't work that way. And he called me 6 months later. He said, let's go work out.
See, that shows the respect the guys had for the business, because it'd be one thing for somebody to walk up to you on the street and say, I want to be a wrestler, and you say, no, there's no way, I'm not going to bother. But when your family comes to you, it'd been really easy, you know, to say, yeah, he's my family, I think I will train him. Instead, he wanted, you know, he made sure to do what he needed to do to make sure you really wanted it.
And you know, and I look back and I respect that.
Yeah.
I mean, whether some people think that was wrong or right or whatever, but that was, and that's just what that was my experience of trying to get in. And
oh. Well, see, you didn't even have to do all that, Jerry. All you had to do was call the Georgia, the Atlanta wrestling office and bring $500, and they'd let you wrestle, wouldn't they, Bobby?
Yes, they would. Oh, jeez. Oh, God.
Bobby, was you, I know you wasn't in the business anymore when they had that power plant. Was that kind of like a joke thing or?
No.
Or?
Jody Hamilton ran that thing, and they would have guys. Jody, me and Jody was talking one day, and when he was doing the Deep South thing when he was a farm system for Vince, and he had it here in McDonough, we were talking, and I'd said something about the power plant, and he said, Bobby, he said, man, he said, Buddy Lee Parker, who wrestled as one of the state troopers, he's a little short fella, but super nice guy, but he's also tough as nails. He actually is the one that did the training. Jody oversaw it, and he said he'd have them guys wearing buckets on their head because they were puking so bad.
No, I know about all that, but I mean, was it just were they charging those guys or
they were charging the guys, but it was also a very legitimate training academy. It was not. I mean, they were busting their butts. They either worked hard to get in the business or they didn't. They were dropped.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can only think of a couple that actually made it through. Made it. The very Big Show came through there. And I don't know if Ray Lloyd came through there. If Ray was already in the business, I think Ray was already in the business.
No, I'm not sure.
He was already in the business.
But Orndorff was training over there as well.
Yeah.
Orndorff and Parker were doing a training.
Well, Dwayne Bruce or Buddy Lee Parker,
yeah.
You know who his partner was in the state trooper, don't you, Jerry?
Veazey.
Somebody you talk. Veazey,
yeah,
Bill Veazey. So, did you have a hand in training Dale Veazey, or was it just
yeah, I trained him.
Mark Brown he trained?
Trained Brown, too. Ed and I trained Veazey.
Dale was a good worker.
He really was.
I'm surprised he didn't go further in the business than he did.
I don't know why he didn't either. I really don't.
I'm surprised. I know you trained Jannetty, too. I'm surprised
yep.
He made it in the business as long as he did after his first match.
First match. Was that down in Mobile? I mean, Dothan?
No, sir. His first match was in Athens, Georgia.
Why don't I remember that?
You talking about Marty Jannetty?
Yep.
Yeah.
I thought he got started up in Minnesota. I didn't know that.
Nope.
Yeah, I trained Marty.
Jerry trained. But his first match outside that gym was in Athens, Georgia. Charlie Smith ran a show up there, and he came up and worked for Charlie.
Who did he work with?
Me.
How was he?
Had a night off, man.
Now there's a kid that I, he was a great amateur wrestler, Marty was, and, you know, I had my gym there, and he said, man, I want you to teach me to wrestle. I said, all right, Marty, you know, I put him off, put him off, put him off. He nearly ran me crazy. And so I said, if you want to do it that bad, Marty, I said, we'll start. And every night after I closed the gym, I only worked with him like, you know, like twice a week on the mats and then had my ring. And but every night he'd get me, he said, show me this hole, show me that hole, blah, 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 after I closed my gym, you know. And he really wanted it. He really did. But the rest is history. But he was very talented.
Yeah, I worked with him up there that night, and of course I knew you had trained him, but yeah, what a pleasure he was to be in the ring with. I mean, I knew if he got a break, I knew he was going to do okay.
Well, that makes me feel proud.
Yeah, he was. We talked after that. I mean, I seen him a few years later, and he was as afraid of me as I was of him. I didn't know he was a good amateur. I probably wouldn't work with him.
He was tough. Marty's very
good. You got
tough.
Him into Kansas City, didn't you, Jerry? Wasn't that the first territory he really worked?
That's what I meant, Kansas City, not Minneapolis. I misspoke there.
Did he work up there as Marty Oates?
I took him to I took him when Scott, you'll remember this, when Larry Manizak started running.
Yes.
I don't know how that happened. Ted was back out there, back in Kansas City, and he had left Columbus and said, I don't want to be in the gym business, you can have it, blah, blah, blah. So he left. He went back to Kansas City, and I had trained Marty. And so Manizak called me, and he said, look, he said, you want to come out here and work for me some? I said, sure. And Ted's working for the Kansas City office, and he's still going to Kansas City for Mutch, Nick, and that group. And so he said, you got anybody you can bring with you? I said, yeah, I got a kid I train. He said, who is he? And I said, his name's Marty Jannetty. He said, can you bring him out here as Marty Oates, your younger brother, yours and Ted's younger brother? I said, sure. So that's how that Marty tells me the last time I talked to him, people still think he's an Oates. That's, you know, I say. But anyhow, that was his first territory, Scott. After all that, we got him booked out there, and he lived with Ted while they were out there.
Yeah, Roger Kirby told me that, I guess about a year ago, he was telling me that Marty's very first match, he wrestled in a mixed tag team match with Cowboy Lang against Roger in Little Tokyo. And,
really?
You were on the card that night, you and Ted and Jerry. I mean, you and Ted worked against the Grapplers.
Oh, okay. All right. I remember you. I was flying back and forth for all that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Marty turned out to be a heck of a worker.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we're in the process of he's in the process of getting his manuscript together. I'm going to be publishing a book, his life story. He tells a lot of bad stories about you, Jerry. Oh, man, women and all the... No, I'm kidding.
But, yeah, I was very proud of Marty, and I know when he was in Kansas City, he called me. He said, look, he said, I got a chance to go to Minneapolis. He said, what do you think? I said, go, Marty. I mean, you know, he stayed in contact with me, and he'd always ask me what I thought and all, and I was very proud of him.
Mm-hmm. He did really well. He's got some wild road stories. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, God. He's got them.
Yeah. Hey, on the subject of fan clubs, I was listening, you know, to the show last week. I really enjoyed used to correspond with me when I was just, you know, I'm still a fan, you know, but... when I was just a fan and I trade results with guys. Well, actually, there was a couple. I used to trade results. Results from Florida to Dayton, Ohio, to Jim Lancaster, real name. And, of course, he got into wrestling. One guy working today with TNA, I could be wrong because I don't follow it, but it's Mike Tenay. He used to do a...
Yeah, sure he did.
Well, 60s, early 70s.
He
you know, that's funny. If you go back and find the old wrestling publications from back in those days, the names of people, you know, Tom Burke, Nick Karch, George Shire, all those type of people who were back in those days just fans. I keep looking for the pen pal section, on these old magazines with Scott's picture in it, but I haven't come across it yet. Did we lose Scott?
No, I'm here. What'd you say? I missed that.
I said, you remember some of those, I think it was the After magazine used to run the pen pal section where everybody would send in their pictures and stuff like that. Every time I come across an old magazine, I look through there and see if your picture's in there, but I haven't found it yet.
Mine was never in there. I never did send that in. I got geared up to want to write about wrestling actually through Wrestling Review in about 1970. I sent a letter, and I couldn't understand why, with all the wrestling, Florida was a hotbed for wrestling back in the 70s, late 80s, early 70s. I mean, they had it going. And I never could understand why the rest of the magazines didn't have more than the other territories. It was always all stuff, which wrestling world, that was almost strictly New York. And so I wrote a letter to Wrestling Review and saying, I'm a fan in Florida. You need
Is that me, guys, or is Scott fading in and out?
I'm getting about every third word.
Yeah, I lost you too.
Looks like he dropped. So you lost him. He'll call back in here in a minute. So you can say something ugly about him until he calls back in real quick. Oh, too late. There he is.
I heard the ugly comment.
Well, I didn't get a chance to make it. You called in too quick.
We
were here about every other word, and we lost you.
Oh, okay. I was just saying I sent in that letter to the Wrestling Review asking them why they didn't carry more on Florida, and I understand now that, they sold most of their magazines in the Northeast, and that's why you saw so much about Bruno. And but they published my letter, and, man, you talk about, I thought that was the coolest thing because I went to the newsstand to buy, I always bought all the magazines, and there's my name in a magazine, and that was the beginning of me writing and doing. I ended up doing a newsletter called The Tampa Scene, and that event, I guess after a couple of months, I changed the name of it to Florida Fanfare because I started printing results from all over the territory. And that actually got me a little bit of heat because I found a newsstand up in Tampa. There was a man, whoever owned the newsstand, I think we just went to the newsstand, asked him if he'd carry them. And he bought a bunch of the newsletters from me for 1 month, put them on his newsstand, and he was selling 15, 20 of them a month. And I guess it back to the wrestling office, because back in those days newsletters were not exposing the business. All it was saying they had wrestlers. This guy's won the match, these guys wrestled in Fort Myers, these guys wrestled in Tallahassee, but that at the time was exposing the business because they didn't want the fans to realize that there was wrestling anywhere other than Tampa, Florida.
Well, they didn't want guys they didn't want the fans to know that we wrestle every night.
That's what I mean. That's what I'm saying. They didn't want you that. They wanted you to think that, in Tampa, they want you to think that was the only place to wrestle. The funny story, when I was, I lived in Bradenton, which is between Fort Myers and Tampa, and I used to have an outdoor antenna mounted to the side of the house. And I got out one day, I don't know what happened, but I got turning that antenna just to see if I could get a better picture. And all of a sudden, I see this real snowy image, and it was one of the wrestlers at the interview table with Gordon Sullivan. I mean, you could barely see it, but you could hear it, and it was Ronnie Garvin. And they were talking about the matches, and I thought they were talking about Tampa, and all of a sudden they said something about wrestling on Tuesday night, the same night as Tampa, at the Fort Myers Armory. And I thought, I can't believe this. These guys wrestle twice a week. I never realized, they wrestle every single. But that's really what got me I thought, well, I started thinking, what if they wrestle in other places? So I started going to the newsstand, checking out papers from Jacksonville and Miami, and sure enough, here they wrestle every night of the week. Well, then when I put them in the newsletter and started sending them around, the office was a little bit, hot about it. Buddy Cole told me this years ago, and they didn't like it because they didn't want, like you said, Jerry, they didn't want fans to know there was wrestling. They wrestle every night of the week.
They sure didn't.
I was think that would only be a problem if they were doing, you know, changing the title, which I never agreed with Fuller the way he booked. You know, if they changed the title in Mobile, you know, on Tuesday night, they changed it in Birmingham on Monday night, they changed it in Dustin on Saturday night, you know, the same thing. You know, give the guy the title back and he'd come back and ring with it and lose it again. And I would think if you were publishing results, that would be the only way that would would get heat. But see, more, me growing up here in Mobile, you know, they just, this territory was not booked that way. They had different programs and guys wore different matches and different finishes every night of the week in different towns. It was rare to see a repeat match unless something was real hot, like Kelly and Fargo. That was real hot. So they main event Pensacola on Sunday night, main event Mobile on Wednesday night, and main event somewhere in Mississippi, you know, on Thursday night. You know, but that was it. But the finishes weren't the same. They weren't the same type matches. You know, they may have a brass knucks match in Pensacola, but then they'd have a, you know, be part of a tag team match in Mobile and, you know, like that. And to me, that's, I know it's harder to book that way because you've got so many, many things up in the air, but it just, it makes it more realistic to me.
Nick Goulas was terrible about booking consecutive title changes. In fact, you know, in the 60s, you know, he'd have them in every town. They lose the title in every single town. Eddie, on the other hand, they didn't do that because they'd actually publish in the program where they won the title. That, you know, and right. the program that they used at the time, it was like Bicycle, just like the tapes. They used the same program, but they just changed the lineup on the inside. But they would say when it's Jacksonville, they'd say he won the title in Tampa last week. But it was actually, they just did not like fans knowing that there was more than one, that wrestling was in more than one place. They did not want them to know that. And I could see that because it made people realize, you know, how can these guys do this every single night, wrestle the same guys? You know, they may have been mixed up a little bit in the type of matches they had, but for all practical purposes, it was the same thing.
That's one thing, they give the rundown every week here on television where what towns they were in here.
Wow.
So, I mean, it's like, especially Mississippi. Mississippi was treated as a totally different promotion. Every once in a while, they'd have a little crossover. They'd show something that, they'd show something that happened, you know, on the Mobile end, like the deal with Shane and Lee Fields, the fight they got into on TV. They showed that on Mississippi TV because they knew that that was a hot enough angle that they could draw people from Gulfport and Pascagoula and places like that because it was close enough that they would travel to do that, to come
right.
See it. But other than that, yeah, they run down the whole list. And Pensacola TV, now the Pensacola TV only mentioned Mobile and Pensacola. They'd say, you know, these are the matches on Sunday night, these are the matches on Wednesday night. They didn't mention Mississippi, they didn't mention the Dothan yet. Dothan TV did the same thing. They would tell, okay, this is what's in Panama City, this is what's in Dothan, this is what's in New Brunswick or wherever else they were running. And then in Mississippi, they ran down all the towns there. So this territory was literally three different promotions when using the same guys. And I know Goulas was probably in his heyday the same way because they had, six live televisions?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, it's...
And they promoted Kentucky.
More stuff because, they were more spread out. So.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. All the way from, I mean, you're talking about East Tennessee over to Memphis. West Tennessee,
yeah.
I mean, about 400 miles. So.
They went into, did he have Louisville then, or was that Brozers back in those days?
It was his, you know, yeah, he had, I don't know when he picked up Louisville, I would say, actually Jerry believed did that, Jerry Jarrett, and that was probably 67, 68, I guess.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit later, but, yeah, absolutely. That's something else Nick did was the interns, Tom Renesto, actually not Tom Renesto, Jim Starr and Billy Garrett at the time, but later on it was, you know, Tom Andrews took Billy's place. But they were hot. I mean, big time hot. And Nick had two or three, maybe even four sets of interns making the rounds because they had six in the night.
Wow. I'm surprised that they bought. I mean, because they were so hot, people had to pay attention to them on TV. They worked letting guys in like that. Well, Floyd did something similar to that when he first started running down here after he bought Lee out. And I said they started running here in March of '78, and around May, June, somewhere in there, in the summer of '78, they had a guy. They had Kurt Von Hess in here working as the superstar. They would have Bill Eady cut promos on Atlanta TV, you know, talking about working with Ron Fuller or whatever in Mobile or whatever, and they send it out here and they show it on there, but then Eady wouldn't show up to work. It was Kurt Von Hess. So.
When the interns were up there, was Ken Ramey with them?
Yes, he was. He'd only make the towns though with Jim or Billy or Jim and Tom. He wouldn't go with any of the other guys. I don't know what. I guess they just didn't have him there in the, you know, in the spot shows. But I'm sure Jim and Billy would make the main towns, the big towns, and then the other guys would go to the small spot shows. But I mean, they ran for four, five, six towns. I've got the booking books here for 75, 76, and I think 72, I believe. And you would not believe the number of shows in those books that those guys, I don't know how they kept it straight. I mean, they had 70, 80 guys territory or more. You know,
I don't know.
Bill Bowman sat on there one time. He told us what their schedule was when they were there as the Sky Brothers. And he said that they'd be in the territory, you know, 6 months and run into somebody that they thought was new in the territory. And he'd been there 6 months to a year, too. They just never crossed paths.
I heard him say that. I thought that was hilarious. Oh, my. That's funny.
But, we would go back to what we were talking about, McMahon being a successful promoter. That's the only thing that I hold against him was, and I know the territories with the, you know, technology and everything, the territories were probably going to die anyway. But
yes.
I think he could have figured out a way to keep, you know, six or seven territories going. Not as many as it was at the heyday, but, you know, keep a Midwest territory, keep a Southern territory, keep a West Coast territory, and, you know, give guys, you know, more, allow more guys to work in the business. I mean, that was what he killed it for me. I mean, what Jerry was saying, he went in and bought up all the big talents and all these other promotions had, but he didn't do anything with them. He had too many top guys in the heyday of, say, 85, 86. He had too many top guys. When you've got, you know, an opening match is JYD against Nikolai Volkov, that's, you got too much talent at the top. You know, there was no room for the prelim guys, the guys that used to do TV and stuff like that, other than just doing TV jobs. You know, there was no room for any up and comers. Everybody had to be a superstar, and everybody, you know, and that's my only gripe with the way the business is now. You know, they don't have somebody to bring in and groom and watch them grow.
I often wondered the two if Vince ever thinks that perhaps he should have kept the territories because he killed his whole feeder system.
Well, here's my biggest rub with the whole thing with him. He put so many people like myself, Bobby, Mike, yourself, and we couldn't count how many people out of the business.
Yes.
You know, where we could be promoting towns for some office or looking after stuff for an office. I mean, we were done.
Yeah.
Once he sucked them all up, we were done. Our you know, love for it and knowledge of it was pushed to the side, and I know at one time when it all really first happened, there was more talent sitting at home than he had.
Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah, because, I mean, I think had he had, you know, it may be because he's such a and reading in Jim Dillon's book, he is such a micromanager and everything. He is so hands-on and wants so much control of everything. But there's no reason why he couldn't, set himself up to be what Sam Muchnick was with the NWA and had all the promoters, all these various promoters and all these territories working under him and him getting his cut of everything and still made probably not as, he probably wouldn't have made, it would probably taken him 20 years to become a billionaire as opposed to 10 years, but, he still would have had more money than he could spend.
You could have taken the top guys out of each of those territories and had your pay-per-views.
Yeah,
there's a lot of ways it could have been done,
exactly. You could have run, because I think about this, if I had the money, how would I do it if I were going to, restart the wrestling business? But he could have, he had cable, he'd gotten TBS, he had, what was he on, USA?
USA.
He could have had, even into the 90s when they, when they were having the Monday Night Wars and they started going to different towns, he could have done that. But what he could have done was he had a two-hour show. Rather than do all that talking and backstage skits and all that stuff, what he could have done was, okay, we're filming from, say, Los Angeles as a territory. We're filming from Los Angeles this week. We're going to spotlight and let all the live matches be the guys who are working in Los Angeles territory. But in between, we're going to tell you what's happening in the Tampa office. We're going to tell you what's happening in the Charlotte office, and do that. And use people like Les Thatcher and Gordon Sully to be like reporters for me. There's, this is what's happening here. And spotlighted all those areas. And still, done just what he's doing now. Done the same thing. Have 4 pay-per-views a year and have each one from a separate territory. And have, instead of 60 guys working for him, have 600 guys working for him.
Jerry, do you miss the business a lot, or do you?
Yes, I do. Bad.
Yeah.
Very bad.
Well, you have to look, put a drink in your backyard and get you some short, some cut off some sneakers, and you can have your own show.
Yeah.
You can be the Savannah World Champion.
Yeah, that would do it. That's all I need.
Well, if he ever finds that cat killer down there, he can have a Texas or a Tybee death match.
We got that under control, man. Did you know CBS Evening News called down here about that?
Are you kidding?
No, sir.
I love it.
I'm known as Columbo.
Do you like your new job, Jerry?
I love it. I couldn't have found anything better.
Yeah. How did you stumble on that?
By me still working out. I met the police chief. My wife and I was down at Tybee. I don't live at Tybee, but we were down there working out. And he walked in one day, and big guy, works out. And he kept, I told my wife, I said, that guy keeps staring at me, man. I said, big guy. And he finally come up to me. He said, what's your name? He said, if you don't mind me asking. And I told him, he said, I thought that was you, biggest wrestling fan in the world. And I just asked him, I said, hey, man, if you ever get anything down at Tybee for me to do, I said, let me know. He said, I'll keep that in mind. And sure enough, that happened. And I've never had benefits or anything in my life. I got benefits, and it's just great. It's just and they're super, super, super good to me, and it's great. I really enjoy it. I'm on the beach every day, and
yeah,
it's wonderful.
You know, that's something else that I go back to, the notoriety you guys had. I mean, today, even the fans can't tell you a whole lot about what happened. They couldn't tell you what happened last week or the week before Vince's show. But nobody remembers much of anything once they get out. But in our day, everybody knew who they were. We had, about 2 years ago, we had some of my father-in-law's friends. He went to a therapy class, and these people are all in their 80s. And we had them over for dinner because they're one of these that they all get together at McDonald's every morning for coffee. And we had them over for dinner, and during the talk, my father-in-law, he was telling them that I write books on pro wrestling. And, man, we have four couples now. Every one of them had been to the match. And my father-in-law never went to a match, never knew anything about it, never cared anything about it. These people started talking about Jackie Fargo, Lynn Rossi, Tojo Yamamoto, and my father-in-law sitting there with his mouth open. He could not believe it. He thought wrestling was just some little side thing that some people went to, but every single one of those couples had been to the matches in Nashville, used to go when they were young. And I thought that was just amazing. You know.
Well, that's what people don't understand. And Nashville is a little bit different because it's a bigger city, but Nashville has never had a major sports team. Atlanta has had the Falcons and the Braves. But, like, down here in the 60s and 70s, the Mobile had nothing. So these guys that were on TVs, these were the stars.
That's absolutely.
I've told this before, but about 10 years ago, Bob Kelly and I drove over to Hattiesburg, and we drove over to where the Wade Kennedy Arena was. It's since torn it down. But we were sitting there in his car in the parking lot, and people were coming out of their houses and coming up and talking to him. And Bob Kelly hasn't been in a wrestling ring in 35 years.
Isn't that amazing?
These people remember. And you know, it's the same way. You know, I've got a friend of mine that grew up in Memphis, and he and I worked together in the concrete business several years ago, and you know, he was a big Jackie Fargo fan. Well, right after I came off the road with the circus, he and I met for lunch, and I was telling him about our show, and I was telling him about the show that we did with Jackie, and he tuned in and listened to it, and he listened to one with Donnie, and he's, I don't know how many more he's listened to, but, you know, people remember stuff like that because it's, you know.
I'll tell you something. When the satellite, when the superstation thing first hit at Channel 17, and we started traveling and going around different places, I want to tell you something. If you think it ain't something to get off an airplane in a city you've never been to and people know who you are, but it's real good for the ego. I mean, it is. I went with Charlie Smith to Dean Silverstone's reunion a few years ago. And me and Charlie got off the airport, and there's a guy standing there, and he goes, "Bobby Simmons and Charlie Smith." And I looked at Charlie, and I said, "Who's this?" He said, "I don't know." And the guy says, "I'm here to take you to Dean's." And I said, "Well, how did you know who we were?" He said, "Oh, I've been researching y'all." And I said, "What do you mean researching us?" We got in his car. He had wrestling magazines. And he had found pictures of Charlie at the federal prison, and he had found pictures of me refereeing. And he said, "This is how I know who you were."
But Charlie wasn't there refereeing at that federal prison.
He was a prisoner. It had a number out, but it was kind of turned sideways.
When Charlie tells people he went to Georgia State for college, he doesn't mean Georgia State the college. He meant the Georgia State Penitentiary.
Well, you know, hey.
Yeah, you know, Bob Roop never wrestled down in Mobile very much, I don't know, Mike, did he wrestle for Southeastern?
No, he never came. He never even came in for Southeastern. Because by the time they opened up the Mobile territory, I think he and Garvin had split. I think they had already split from the Knoxville territory.
Okay.
So they never came down here.
We were down there. Bob and I went to the Mobile reunion. It was probably 10 years ago. We went in Walmart, and we went in the electronic. We were getting some. He needed some tape or something like that. Y'all remember tapes? What those were?
Yeah.
8 tracks.
Think of that. Yeah. I think we're getting cassette, regular cassettes. But anyway, we walked up to the cashier to check out, and this girl couldn't have been. I would say she probably wasn't 35 years old, probably. And she looked and she says, "Are you Bob Roop?" Now, this is in Mobile, Alabama, where he's never wrestled. She says, "Are you Bob Roop?" And he says, "Yeah." And she started talking about how she remembered him wrestling. She probably saw him. I don't remember what she said, but she probably saw him on WCW, I would imagine, on to Turner Station. But this was all the way in Mobile, Alabama, in what, 2000, probably the year 2000, 2001, and he hadn't been wrestling for 20 years, and I was just amazed.
you may remember this, Scott, and this is just kind of coincidence since I sent you that rare photo. I don't remember if you were there or not, but we were all sitting outside the hotel. This is probably 10, 12, 15 years ago. We're sitting outside that hotel one day, you know, how everybody had pulled their chairs out there and sat on the sidewalk. Burrhead Jones and his wife had the very last room on the front side of the hotel, way down at the end, and he was sitting down there. And these two young guys came into the parking lot, and they got out, and they were trying to sell jewelry. And they were up there, and they were trying to sell watches and chains and gold chains and stuff. And, you know, of course, nobody would buy anything. Well, they got in their car, and they started to leave. And they got down to the end of the building, and they locked the car down. It was like, and they jumped out. Now, these guys were probably in their early 20s. And, you know, I don't know how long it had been since Burrhead had wrestled there, but these guys jump out of the car, and we heard them scream, Burrhead Jones. They knew who he was.
That's unreal.
I mean, it's just, you know, I don't think we even realized how far-reaching that this stupid business was. And here again, just another story to go along with this. I went to school with a guy named Tommy Masters, and Tommy joined the Army right out of high school. And I've been out of high school 40 years. I hadn't heard from him in years. About 2 years ago, on Facebook, he popped in there and started communicating with me a little bit. And he sent me a private message, and he says, I think you might enjoy this story. He said, I was stationed in Italy, and he said, my sergeant invited me over for dinner on a Saturday night, him and his family and his kids. And he said, come on over. He said, we got some videotapes that my family sends me from the States. We'll watch American TV. He said he gets over there. He said he sits down with his sergeant. His sergeant puts a tape in. The kids are in the other room. The wife's in the kitchen. He puts in a tape, and it's Georgia Championship Wrestling. And I was refereeing. And Gordon evidently mentioned my name, and Tommy said, God, Bobby Simmons said, man, I went to school with him. He says the guy pauses the tape, calls the wife and the kids out of the other room, and he was like all of a sudden an instant celebrity because he knew me from high school. And that was in Italy. I mean, you know, we had no idea.
That's funny.
Had no idea.
Yeah, it was the thing. Yeah, and that's another thing about territories. People talk about coming back and promoting weekly or monthly or whatever. And, you know, we talked about that territory's just not going to come back because, you know, just you can't keep anything secret. And Mike, you made the mention that the territories were going to go out anyways, and I agree. Something else you said back then, wrestling was about the only thing for people to go do.
Yeah,
you know.
Exactly.
And so that's why they went every week. I mean, every week. People had, you know, they had, you know, tickets for
yep.
Decades of their family owned them, you know, and ringside tickets. But I just don't think it could do it anymore. People just don't have, they're just not going to go to something on a weekly basis. Plus, society is so much faster now. You know,
right.
we don't,
right.
Back then they had the time. That's all they wanted. That's all they did. You know, they went to wrestling
matches. Back then there was only three channels on TV. So,
well, another thing too, we've talked about this before. I remember sitting in a meeting in the Atlanta office when we decided, or we were talking about going from $5 for ringside seats to $5.50. And
yeah.
Barnett's bone of contention with doing it was, you know, we're talking about a guy that works for $200 or $250 a week. Then you take the taxes out of that, and he's down to $190, $195, $200, whatever it is. He said, if he's got a family of four, he said, we're talking about taking not only $20 of his money, but now we're talking about taking $22 of his money. He says, if he buys a program, if he buys four hot dogs and four Cokes, plus he parks, he said, we're talking about taking a third of this guy's net pay every week because we were based on them people coming every week. And, you know, we're talking a $2 raise. The territory days, the cost of things would be so prohibitive now.
Absolutely.
The charges you would have to charge for the tickets. The guys don't work for $15 anymore.
Right.
You know, the parking, the cost of the building. And if you're going to do a promotion right, the cost of the insurance to protect yourself. I mean, yeah, it would be just, I mean, almost impossible. And Jerry's promoted more recently than anybody that I know of has that I talk to regularly, and he can probably tell you this. I mean, I imagine the cost was just astronomical just to indemnify yourself to keep some idiot from suing you over nothing.
And you can't imagine what these guys wanted to come and work for.
Oh,
they were telling me what they would work for. I said, what?
Yeah.
I was paying some guys $250, $300, $400 a week.
Yeah.
A week for one night.
Bubba, you could have got me as a special referee on a regular basis for that kind of money. I might have moved back down there.
I didn't know if you'd come for that.
Gas isn't 50 cents a gallon either.
There
you
go.
Got that right.
It's all changed. It's, you know, I thought I really could do it. I had a great thing, a beautiful building, and it was just too expensive. It was too expensive.
Yeah.
But well, in a way, and this is going back to what we've been talking about with the internet, in a way, the territories do somewhat still are still alive the way they used to be. Somebody somewhere along the line, I read the quote that YouTube is the last standing wrestling territory because you can go on there and see matches from just about any era and any territory if you take the time and look for them. But I wanted to mention some of the sites out there and give props to some of the sites that are dedicated to the old school days. First and foremost, of course, being Georgia Wrestling History, because that's what we're a part of. But I first discovered that when I first got the internet, probably 99, 2000, the first site I discovered was Scott's. WrestlingLegends.com, or OneWrestlingLegends.com, and through his, it led me to Wrestling Classics, Kayfabe Memories. That was before Rich started the Georgia Wrestling History site. But there's sites out there. There's one called Steel Belt Wrestling that's dedicated to Pittsburgh, Cleveland, in Buffalo, the old NWF territory. It's got tons of pictures, tons of clippings, tons of stories from different things. Kayfabe Memories was really going strong until it crashed about 2002, 2003, and we really have not gained back the following that we had then. It used to be you could sign on, there'd be 200 or 300 people on there. Now you're lucky if there's 10. But it's still a good site. There's, you know, the message boards are a little overrun by guys who, you know, are arguing to talk about the current stuff or more current stuff, because the rule there is we don't talk about anything past 1989, which is other than they've got a board for Smoky Mountain and for Global, because they came along, even though they came along later, they were run as territories. But you know,
is Vince Fahey still running that?
Yeah, as far as
I
know.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm actually an administrator on that site, but the only thing I do, Dave Jason and I got a thing going where he sends me photos out of his collection. I'm posting some. I've been posting them in the Detroit board for about a year now, and then we just started about a month or so back on Los Angeles. And just some great photos, brings back a lot of memories. And a lot of the photos that, I don't know if, Scott, you remember in 73 or so when Victor Rivera was working out in Los Angeles and was the America's champion, that they ran an angle out there where Tolos busted him open on TV and the doctor sewed him up on live TV. And that was on the cover of one of those magazines. But Dave took all those photos.
Wow.
And, I've been posting some of those in sequence of how that whole thing was played out. The main site, we haven't done anything in years on it, but then you still has access back when a lot of the boys were coming on there and writing stories. I know Bob Kelly wrote a bunch of stories there. I wrote, you know, a handful. Bobby, didn't you write some?
Yeah, I wrote 15, 20 stories there.
Tom Hankins, Mike Dupree, Jim Lancaster, all these guys still hit that site, you know, and so will answer questions and anything. So even though it's not what it used to be, it's still a good place to go. Wrestling Classics is, I don't think it gets overwhelmed with other stuff, but
I still hit it every once in a while because people put up results and stuff, old results, and I love stuff like that. But again, the Scott site was the first one I found. When did you start your site, Scott?
Man, that's a good question. I'd say probably 2000, 2001. I can't
say. I knew it was around 2000 that I discovered it, I think.
Yeah, it probably was. I was somewhere around there. But yeah, I check in the message board every day. I check in the Peach State Pandemonium every day and Kayfabe Memories, and that's about the extent of what I there's some others I check on a fairly regular basis, but
Phil Bellwin, he doesn't really update it a whole lot, but if you've never been to it, just a ton of stuff there. I can't think of the guy's name, but there's a guy that's got a site for the old Indianapolis territory, the Bruisers territory. There's one for Memphis wrestling. There's one for national wrestling. And another one that's been out there probably almost as long as yours is Barry Rose's site, Championship Wrestling for Florida. That's kind of tough.
That's another one I check quite often.
He's it's all out there. I would love to, if I had the time and the energy and the money, I would love to build a site for this territory down here because this territory was so overlooked and didn't get a whole lot of press coverage otherwise.
But you know,
Lee didn't let him in here.
That's right. He wouldn't have magazines and wouldn't let photographers and anything, you know. And in a sense, that's sad because there's so much of the history that's been lost. And I understand why he did it. He didn't want the exposure. He didn't want people to, know about, like we were talking about. He didn't want people to know there's wrestling in all these other different cities. But they did lose a lot by not allowing anybody at all in there. You think they would have liked to lease stuff in Wrestling Review or some places like that.
I think Little Al Vavasor was able to run a few things sporadically.
Yeah.
Wrestling Review did a story on Rick Tyler and Eddie Sullivan that I think Gene Gord wrote.
Yeah.
There was one on Bob Kelly. The only thing of the aftermags, Inside Wrestling, the wrestler ran a story on the story was on Bobby Shane and him firing Sherry, but it was built around a match that he and Terry Garvin had with Kelly and Lucas here in Mobile. But of course, I'm sure Shane was Shane all that stuff, the information, everything. So, because it was basically about him, Kelly and Lucas were just mentioned, and then there was photos of him, and that was it. It wasn't like they were trying to further an angle or anything. But that's pretty much it. Now, when they were in running in Louisiana in the 60s, they did a little bit more stuff. There were stories I've seen on Bobby Fields working with the Daltons and Thatcher and Kirby and all working with the Daltons. But I think, again, that was all from Little Al Vavasor because he was living in Baton Rouge. So, pretty much took the photos and either he wrote the stories or somebody wrote them for him.
That's pretty interesting stuff.
Well, we're just about out of time. You got anything you want to plug, Scott, while you're with us?
I got the Nikita Koloff book coming out in 2 weeks. People wonder whether it's going to be a preachy book. It's not at all. He talks his entire story about how he grew up and got into the wrestling business and goes up through his time in WCW and what happened with his wife dying. And it's a good biography. And that'll be out at the end of the month. I got 4 or 5 books I'm working on now with different guys. And Jerry, when you talk to Steinborn, tell him to get going. Man, I've been pushing him for 6-7 years now to do his book.
I don't understand that at all.
I called him 3 weeks ago. I called him. I said, Dick, I said, you keep talking about this, and I said, you've talked about it for the past 10 years, I said, you're going to be dead one day, and you're not going to have your story told. And I said, you need to tell it. Go ahead and do it. And he says, you know, you're right. And so I got him set up, but he's going to video it. But whether he started, I'm going to probably call him tonight when I get on the road. But I wish he would, because he has a real story to tell.
I know he does. I mean, he really does. He really does. He covered a lot of generations there. And
absolutely. Oh, yeah, he worked with everybody. Absolutely. Well, I'm going to run then, and thank you all very much. I really appreciate it.
Listen, you've been
super
interesting, man, and it's great to hear you.
Oh, it was a pleasure to be on, absolutely. So let me know. I'll be happy to come on anytime. And I got some guys that would love to come on anytime you'd like. Just let me know.
Well, you let me know who they are, and we'll schedule.
Okay. Sounds good.
Just give me an email or something, and we'll work out getting them on there, because I think Bobby, Jerry, and I have told all the stories that we can tell. We're starting to repeat ourselves.
Starting to.
But
they're always
yes.
That's the thing about wrestling stories. It's like no matter how many times you hear them, like I've heard some of Bobby's stories in Mobile, Alabama. I hear a lot of them. I've been going down there for, 20 years? Well, not 20 years, say 16 years now. Some of those stories I've heard every single time I've been down there, and it just tickles me to death every time I hear them. They're so funny. Something about wrestling stories is just good.
That's true.
Yeah, I got a Kansas City T-shirt story for you this year. You're going to love it.
You too.
Oh, I love that. I'd like to hear a new twist on it. Well, you guys take care, and thank you again. I really appreciate you having me on.
Thank you very much.
Scott, thank you. Be safe out on the road, my boy.
I will. Y'all have a good night. I'll talk to you soon.
You too, Scott. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, guys, that wraps it up for this week. Appreciate Scott being on with us. And appreciate you guys bearing with me and my I sound like Charlie Smith over here. Not quite good.
You made it.
Yeah, you did good.
All right, guys. Well, hopefully I'll be a little bit better situation next week, and we'll see what we can get into next week. We'll talk to you guys then.
Good night, guys. Okay. Have a good week.
Bye-bye. All right.
By GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, and more. As always, GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com thanks you for your continued support.